Frank Ficino Jr. and I got together a few years ago at a conference, and he'd been working on the Flatwoods Monster case.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the Dawn of America Live?
Lo and behold, there were the articles where the Air Force instructed its pilots to shoot them down if they don't land when ordered to do so. And I hadn't known a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't in the Times, the Washington Post, and so forth. So what I'm saying is this is an aspect of the whole problem that hasn't been considered, and that's why I recommend Frank's book, Shoot Them Down. Three of the pilots were people who'd had over 100 combat missions in Korea where there were MiGs trying to shoot them down.
Yeah.
They survived that and they come back to the States and they crashed.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no networks, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 8 Live. And as usual here, we are broadcasting from the outskirts of Boston, Massachusetts, which is home to the world champion Boston Red Sox. I just want to get that in there. It's been quite a month here in the Massachusetts area, and we're all very thrilled. Congratulations to the Sox. Thank you for an awesome ride. And we're getting ready for an awesome ride to take place in just a few moments. We're doing another first-time guest here on the program. Our guest is Frank Ficino. He is the author of a couple of groundbreaking and outstanding books, The Braxton County Monster, as well as Shoot Them Down, The Flying Saucer Air Wars of 1952. And I owe a big thanks to Alfred Lemberg and Jeremy Vaney, both for recommending Frank Ficino. I can't believe those two guys worked in tandem on this one. But a long time ago, Alfred Lemberg wrote to me and suggested Frank, and somehow it got lost in the shuffle. And then recently, Jeremy Vaney also recommended Frank, and I said, everybody keeps recommending Frank Ficino. And I had Stan Friedman on the show 5 years ago, and that's where you heard those clips here that began the program, and he was raving about Frank's work. So it's long, long, long overdue that we got him on the program. Frank, welcome to BOA Audio. Thank you for being patient enough and finally arriving here on BOA Audio. We're really looking forward to it.
Hey, Tim, glad to be here. Didn't we actually meet in Las Vegas a few years ago?
I believe we did, yeah. We met.
Yeah, it was kind of brief. It was kind of a busy conference.
It was, it was quite the event. Yeah, it was a good time, though. Yeah, that was at the crash. I guess Crash Conference, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Second
one. Right.
I think it was 06, and it was in Vegas. It was quite the happening. I remember your presentation. You had a film that you were working on.
Right.
So I guess, you know, to catch people up to speed, we usually do this with the first-time guests, even though we're live and everything. It's, this is for posterity. You know, 100 years from now, somebody could be listening to this, and they're going to need this background information. So tell us a little bit about Frank Ficino. Who are you? How did you get interested in UFOs? And really, you know, how did that interest lead you into this research into the Braxton County Monster and, of course, the Flying Saucer Air Wars of 52?
Well, Tim, about a little over 20 to 21 years ago, I was visiting some relatives in Braxton County, relatives in Flatwoods and Frametown. And I actually started looking into crop circles because there was a lot of crop circles appearing throughout Braxton County. And some of them were actually on my cousin's property. So I started photographing them, taking samples, and, you know, documenting all of these crop circle rings and patterns that were strewn throughout the area. And I was told about a few other ones, so I documented them throughout Braxton County, and I was running around up there with my cousin. And at the time, I was living in Connecticut. That was before I moved to Florida. And I was put in contact with Colin Andrews. And I shared all my data with Colin. And, excuse me, at that point, I didn't know about the Flatwoods Monster. I was making trips to West Virginia and documenting crop circle rings when I had a chance. So I'm talking back and forth for a while with Colin about this, and we were trading notes. And in the meantime, I had found out about this case called the Braxton County Monster.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of stumbled into it. Somebody told me about this, you know, well, you know, this is one aspect of the UFO stuff here with crop circle rings, and there's tons of UFO sightings up there, but the reports rarely came out of the mountains. And I started looking into this case, the Braxton County Monster, or Flatwoods Monster,
right,
also known as. And it wasn't easy at first looking into this case. It intrigued me more the way the people reacted when you said, you know, the Flatwoods Monster. People kind of backed off and wouldn't talk about it. You know, it was like a standoff, and I'm like, oh, this is crazy. What the hell happened here back in 52? The people are still acting weird about this. So I started looking into the case through different periodicals, magazines, books, basically anything I can get my hands on. And I continued going back and forth from Connecticut into West Virginia researching the Flatwoods case. And I started going to different libraries, and I basically combed the whole state of West Virginia, looking through archives, going to museums, libraries. It was unbelievable. I spent years going back and forth and putting this story together. In the meantime, I was put in touch with Kathleen May, who was the primary witness involved in the Flatwoods Monster incident. And over the course of several years, it took me a little time to actually get in with the people and warm up to each other, because they were very standoffish about this whole incident. And it was hard. And even though I had family up there, I'm still considered an outsider.
Right, yeah.
And when outsiders go up into the mountains up there, it's very hard to break in. I remember the first time I met Stanton Friedman, it was back in 1996. I met him in Gulf Breeze at a convention, and we started talking about Flatwoods. I'll never forget, he looked at me. He says, how the hell did you get into those mountains? UFO researchers have been trying to get in there for years. And I told him, I said, I have family there, which made it a little bit easier, but not much. But I did have a little head start on that.
Yeah.
But I basically had to prove myself, Tim, to the people up there of, you know, my sincerity. And I wasn't there to make a joke out of the Flatwoods case like people have done for so many years. When this happened back in 52, it was taken very seriously at the onset, but it turned around drastically. And intelligence was actually up there. There were Air Force officials, you know, that all were covert. And what happened is the media got hold of this thing, and they just made a joke out of it. So the whole community basically shut down and stopped talking about it. So it was hard for people to get in there to actually talk with the people who were involved in
it.
And when I started just over 20 years ago, a lot of the key witnesses were still alive. You have to remember, this is over 60 years ago at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Last year was like the 60th, right?
Right. It's 61 years now. And back at that point in the early 90s, I went to film and video school, and I learned how to work high-end cameras. I had some good teachers. And I was going back and forth. I had moved to Florida. And then I was going back and forth, and I was actually videotaping the different people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have all of this archived, and I put together a little 37-minute documentary that's on YouTube right now, and it shows clips and highlights.
Nice, nice.
The different witnesses. So it was kind of fun. It was a lot of years put into this, but I think, as far as I know, I have the longest investigation into this case in history.
I would imagine, yeah. And folks can check out flatwoodsmonster.com. I believe there's a link right to the video on right when you can get to the page. So they should definitely check that out. Well, let me circle back a little bit, because you reminded me, I was looking at your info, that you did start out on the crop circle investigation. Now, we're going to get deep into Flatwoods and the 52 saucer war, but tell me just a little bit about, because I never even considered I know there's American crop circles, but I didn't even realize that maybe it was big enough that you could actually look into them and investigate them at any depth. So tell me a little bit about what you did looking at those and, you know, what's that all about?
Well, what happened is my cousin purchased property up there quite a few years ago, and the property had sat and it was stagnant for several years. Nobody bought or had bought the property. They didn't touch it. So he had the property for a little while, and then he kind of figured out what the hell was going on because he was seeing UFOs and saucers all over the place, and it was kind of common. And right in the area of Frametown, there was a particular incident that happened in the early 90s that went nationwide, and a flying saucer had flown into one of my cousin's neighbor's backyards. And it was reported, and it was, I think it was on the Maury Povich show.
Oh, boy.
Well, anyways, this was a big story, and that was one of the first major stories to come out of the mountains in years. And the more I started going up and visiting everybody and talking to the locals up there, it was kind of like common, except they didn't want to talk about it. The people up there went through the Flatwoods Monster case, and they're like, oh, we're not going through all this crap again.
Right, right.
We kind of learned our lesson. But this one particular story went nationwide, and they ended up botching it up, and, you know, they edited things poorly, which is seems to be common practice with television. But anyways, I got to be friends with the people who were involved in this case, and I was introduced to different people throughout the mountains and throughout Braxton County, and it was very common to see UFOs. And at first, you know, I took it with a grain of salt. You know, I kind of snicker and laugh at the people, and they would say, well, don't laugh at us, and, you know, go up there in the mountains certain times of the year, certain times of the evening, you know, and there was actually a lot of daytime sightings, and you're going to see this stuff. And it's like, son of a bitch, there we were. I was up there, and I saw myself, and I actually watched them for hours on end. And I went up there with a lot of different friends and family members, and some of the photographs that I took are actually on my website in the Paratopia area. I have a few good shots of some UFOs in flight and making directional changes, and there's some shots of the crop circle. So there was a lot of stuff going on in this one region of Frametown and the outskirts.
Yeah.
And Frametown is actually, if people are familiar with the story, the follow-up story to Flatwoods, where the reptilian was seen by George Natowski
okay.
the day after the Flatwoods case. All of this stuff happened right in that area, and it's still going on.
Makes you wonder what's behind that. You know, what's the source of that interest, let's say, you know?
Well, when you talk to the locals up there,
yeah.
this has been going on up there since the 40s.
Hmm.
And when I did my first book tour back in 2004, I was going all throughout West Virginia, and my hub was in Charleston. I did a lot of book signings throughout the state. And it was very common to have the people telling me about stories that were taking place going back into the 40s and 50s up there. It's kind of funny. There was even one particular incident I'll never forget. This guy walked up to me with his wife, and they had been married for years. And the guy started telling me this unbelievable close encounter case where he saw a bronze craft that was shaped like a disc with a dome on the outskirts of Charleston, where the interstate is. There wasn't where the interstate is now. Back then, there wasn't an interstate.
Right.
But in that particular area, and he's going into explicit detail, and his wife looked at him. And she says, we've been married for like 55 years, and you never told me that story. So I've heard a lot of different stuff like that. But the locals in Braxton County seem to think there's some type of a vortex up there.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the opinion. There's some type of a vortex because they're always seen in one particular region.
Yeah.
And I've seen them up there quite often myself where you see them, and then they just disappear, and then they show up over there. And I've seen, oh, God, as many as a dozen at a time flying around in patterns throughout the sky. And like I said, if you go on my website, you could see a few of the pictures I was able to get.
Now, regarding the crop circles, there's sort of this debate, you know, messages versus sort of like, artifacts of a UFO landing or whatever, UFO incident, you know what I mean? Sort of like a trace case, sort of an effect, if you will. Mm-hmm. What was your take on what you saw for crop circles? What was the makeup of these?
What they actually were, Tim, is they weren't crop circles per se like the ones you see in England.
Right.
They were more like crop circle rings, and they were kind of like banded rings, and they were all over my cousin's property. And actually, he flipped out and went crazy because he had purchased the farm, and he was grooming it up because of, you know, shabby. And he walks out one day and he sees like 60 of them across his property. And he's swearing, calls me up on the phone. He says, got to get your ass up here and document these things and blah, blah, blah. So I went up there with a video camera, you know, and still cameras. And I had all my equipment. And I took soil samples and all different stuff. And I gave all that stuff to Colin Andrews. I'll make a long story short, a couple years later, somebody from Collins' camp had contacted me, and the same formation of crop circle rings had appeared in England.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, it was a couple of years later. And, yeah, that was kind of spooky, you know, West Virginia and England. He had some type of a database system, like fingerprinting, where they cross-reference, and they had popped. So you have crop circles in England and in Braxton County that were basically the same.
Makes you, I wonder if that connects somehow with this portal idea that maybe, you know, maybe that's the doorway of sorts, or the, like I said, the effect of the doorway. Who knows?
And then they eventually went away. The whole grass area basically filled back in, and it grew back in after a few years, and then they appeared again.
Jeez.
About six years later, and I went back up there and I documented all of those and forwarded those to Colin. So there's definitely something going on up there.
Yeah, I'm going to presume it's, you know, not to be pejorative, but it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. So we can assume that these aren't tricksters or pranksters running around on your cousin's farm. Why would they go
away? The one thing I learned, you do not go onto somebody's property in West Virginia when they have a no trespassing sign because you'll get your ass shot off. I was warned of that right off the bat. They say, well, you're kind of a city boy. Just be careful with walking around up here. And you don't walk around somebody else's property up there when it's posted. No trespassing, no hunting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and certainly no crop circle making. So they would not be a fan. all right. Well, that's really weird and interesting, the crop circle aspect of this, because, you know, it's so bizarre and so unique in general. But let's, I guess, move into the Flatwoods story. You've been doing this for 20 years. You've been looking at this for 20 years. Like I said, we're sort of reaching an audience here that's not only listening at the very moment, but could be listening, you know, 50 to 100 years from now. So, and I like to think of the program as sort of the paranormal program of record, so we document all this stuff as best as possible. So give us the thumbnail on the Flatwoods monster case, the Braxton monster case. Give us sort of a thumbnail on what went down there in September 1952 so we can catch everybody up to speed on this story.
Well, we'll go back to when I went into Flatwoods for the first time. I was with my cousin.
Good.
We drove into Flatwoods in his truck, and there's this big sign hanging on the side of the road, "Welcome to Flatwoods, home of the Green Monster." And I'm like, wow, this is wild. And we drove into town, jumped out of the truck, and we were over at the school playground. And we were walking around talking to people there. You know, these are country folk. They're walking their dogs, just hanging out. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't lock your doors up there. You really don't have to. And we're just shooting the breeze with some of the locals, and that's when they started looking at me like I was nuts when I was saying, you know, what do you know about the Flatwoods Monster?
Right, and this is like the early 90s, right?
Yeah, this was just over 20 years ago, 20, 21 years ago. And I didn't know anything about the case, and I started talking to some different people up there, and, you know, they just kind of laughed at it. And then I started looking into it a little bit deeper when I got back to Connecticut. I went to Yale Library, all New Haven, Bridgeport Libraries, and I was hitting every place looking up the stuff for September 12th, 1952. And I was going to the different bookstores throughout Connecticut and in New York, used bookstores, and I was looking at New Age. And I started finding out that there was no two stories about the Flatwoods Monster case that were the same. The story had become so convoluted, it was unbelievable. Here I have a collection of books, magazines, and every single one was different. And I saw what had happened, how the people were made fun of, and how they just shut down. So I kept going back up there, and I eventually was put in touch with Kathleen May, the primary witness. And she was sick on and off for several years. And at the point when I started looking into this, she was very sick. So I just basically did interviews with her and talked to her over the telephone. And I was going to different people's homes. They were like, go talk to this one. He was involved. This one saw this. So every trip up there, I'm banging on doors, calling people up, being a pain in the neck, and trying to find out what happened. Well, Kathleen kind of coordinated everything
right. And
would call the people ahead because I was having trouble getting in there. There was a couple little instances of myself going into town, and I learned I don't walk around with a $50,000 camera slung over my shoulder with a tripod and walk into like a breakfast cafe because, you know, there'll be 30, 40 people in there clinging to forks and blah, 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 and they all stop. And they all stare at you and look at you, and you hear them like, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't fit in. And so I started traveling more with my cousin instead of going by myself because I didn't like going through the mountains by myself. You hear a lot of crazy stories.
I can imagine, yeah. Now, just to jump in for a moment, given that you've dedicated 20 years to really setting the record straight about this story, you're kind of like more... I won't go so far as to say beloved, but are you more accepted by the locals there now? Or are they kind of like, that's Frank, he's on our side?
Yeah, actually, the whole community took me in. It wasn't overnight,
but
I basically vindicated the people, and nice. You know, the proof is in my books. And it's funny, whenever I don't drive up there anymore, that's too long of a drive from Florida, I'm over that. But flying in and out of Huntington and out of Charleston, it's just funny whenever I landed in the airports, the people all walk up to me and they recognize me because I've been on the news up there probably 100 different times, and everybody recognizes me and comes over and shoots the breeze with me. So it's kind of cool. More people know me up there than in Florida.
I can imagine, yeah.
You know, so basically I was accepted up there.
Nice.
Because I kind of... For lack of better terms, I kind of represented them almost as an attorney because there were so many people have tried to beat this story down and they can't because I come back with the proof and the evidence because I have a ton of government documentation.
Yeah.
I have firsthand eyewitness account and I have the Colonel Levin interview. So, and then the main thing is all the Project Blue Book documents.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple pounds of paper just for September 12th and 13th, 1952.
Oh, wow.
And that is where everything just went crazy when I started looking outside of Flatwoods. It's kind of funny, Tim. A couple, about 3 years ago, I was in Charleston, and I was bringing different souvenirs and different things back, and my suitcase was over the 50-pound limit. It was 52 pounds.
Yeah.
Right? And they said, you're going to have to take something out of there, Mr. Fischino. And I went over, and I had my Project Blue Book September 12th and 13th sheets.
Yeah.
And I pulled that out, and it went down to 50 pounds. So I actually, honest to God, I actually have 2 pounds worth of documents for Project Blue Book that have to do with the Flatwoods case and what happened throughout the United States on that one night. And September 13th, there's a handful of documents. So there's a lot of stuff going on. That's a true story, too. So I just carried that Project Blue Book
paperwork
on is my carry-on.
Okay. Nice. Holy crap. All right, so taking us back to your investigation and everything, how did everything unfold that night? I guess so we can catch people up.
Well, we have this story where a bunch of kids had seen a fireball go over the elementary school playground,
mm-hmm.
Of Flatwoods, And one of the key points here, Tim, is Flatwoods is the geographical dead bullseye center of the state of West Virginia. And if you look at a map of the eastern United States and mid-Atlantic area, Flatwoods is actually just about 200 miles due west of Washington, D.C., which is going to come into play later.
Okay.
So basically, if you stood in Washington at a high point and looked west 200 miles, you're going to see Flatwoods.
All right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's a key point. Well, anyways, I was September 12, 52. It was just before 7:30 that night, and a bunch of kids were out playing football, pickup ball on playground, and this gigantic flaming object, it was basically shaped like an egg, and was about 16 to 18 feet high and approximately 32 feet long. And it flew from the north, headed south. It flew over a mountaintop at very low level, flew over the school, made a 45-degree angle turn, and flew across the Route 4 and landed up on a mountaintop on a Bailey Fisher farm across the street. So the kids see this thing go over. Some of them are yelling, it's a UFO, it's a saucer. Some are yelling, it's a meteor, the little kids. And these kids, you know, were ranged. You know, they were average about 10 years old up to 18.
Okay.
And they were all screaming, let's go check this thing out. And they ran up the street approximately a mile to the house of Kathleen May. And Kathleen May's house is on Depot Street, and it sits just in back of the train depot. This was the access road that actually led up onto the Bailey Fisher Farm. So what we have here is this bunch of kids running into Kathleen's house. Two of the boys in the group were Freddie May and Eddie May. Eddie May was 13, and his kid brother Freddie was 11. I worked with Freddie and Kathleen very close over the years. They were the ones who really went above and beyond to help me with this and got me connections with other people in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So these kids go screaming in the front door. Something landed up on the back hill at a Fisher farm. And Kathleen May, she was a beautician. She worked in town. She had just got home, and she had her 1950s era little beautician outfit. She had a hat on with her uniform. And the oldest boy in the group, Gene Lemon, that was her first cousin. And Gene, being the oldest one, he was kind of in charge of getting all of the kids together.
Right.
And he went up onto the farm with Kathleen May. Well, some of the kids chickened out and went home because they were scared. And in the end, we actually have Kathleen May, Gene Lemon. We had 14-year-old Neil Munley, Teddy Neal. He was 13, so, as well as Eddie. We had Freddie May, 11, Ronald Shaver, 10. They were on the playground, and a little kid from the neighborhood had heard the commotion, and his name was Tommy Heyer, and he was 6 years old. So we have a bunch of boys between 6 and 18 years old. There were seven of them. Kathleen May was 32 years old.
Oh, wow.
It's dusk, and here goes this wagon train of West Virginia folk up into the back to check out what had happened.
Yeah.
And the layout of the land, this is very important because this kind of gives you an overview of the farm, okay?
Mm-hmm.
There's three sections to the farm, Tim. The first section to the farm is a big, wide-open pasture field.
Okay.
And you walk across the field, and over to the left-hand side of the property facing north, in the corner of the property is a big, gigantic gate. And this, it's a steel gate, and this separated the first pasture of the farm from the middle pasture.
All right.
The middle pasture of the farm is a big gully, and it sweeps down from the left-hand side down to the right, and there was woods on the left-hand side. That's the number two pasture.
Mm-hmm.
The third pasture was where this thing had touched down and landed way up on the back part of the Fisher property.
Okay.
And that's where the boy saw this thing stop in midair. It didn't come down, you know, in a trajectory where it crashed and impacted into the earth. The thing kind of hovered and just dropped straight to the ground below the tree lines.
Like a lay landing, almost.
Yeah, right. And this thing was on fire, flames, there's pieces falling off of it, and it kind of stopped and just dropped below the horizon line of where, their point of view, because they're down in the valley looking up higher.
Mm-hmm.
So they're walking up onto the first pasture of the farm. And I worked close with Kathleen for several years and interviewed her several times and a lot of audio and video recordings, and I always took notes when I got together with her. One of the main things that Kathleen was always talking about is she was starting to head up onto the hill when the first pasture. When she got across the crest, she said there was a big, gigantic, purplish flare, and the whole farm lit up. She wasn't on the farm. She was going up the walkway, which was like a dirt path, and she saw the flare out in the backside of the farm, and
yeah.
She didn't know what it was. They cleared the crest of the hill where the walkway was. It's like a driveway now. And as they started walking into the path, they were looking, and the kids were pointing. That's where it went down, was way back there.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole group walk across the first pasture. In the meantime, there was a collie from the nearby neighborhood that had joined the group. It was a big collie dog. And Freddie May reminded me of the size of this dog. It was big. Freddie had a dog, and Gene Lemon also had a dog. They were from the same litter. They were little mid-sized dogs. So we have this group of eight people, two adults leading the group, Kathleen and Gene Lemon. They're walking across the path, and this big collie walks across, and is hanging out with them.
Right.
They got up to the first fence, and they opened the fence up. They all passed through it, and they closed it up behind them. Now, as they're walking up a little bit further, which is actually east at this point, the woods are to the left-hand side of them.
Okay.
And their path starts ascending and going up, mm-hmm. because it's going towards the back, and over to the right-hand side is where that gully is. And to the right-hand side of the path, there was brush. And a lot of the kids couldn't see up above that point because this brush was surrounding the area. The farm was unkept.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw something flashing out in the distance. Now, at that point there, what had actually happened is when the craft touched down in the back, Tim, it actually relocated and settled itself and nestled in the corner of the farm, and there was a small pear tree orchard back then in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was kind of tucked away in back of these pear trees. Some of the kids saw this thing intermittently flashing. The older boys, they could see up over the brush. They saw this thing flashing.
Yeah.
And the kids are very adamant about, we saw up there. So they have their eyes focused, looking straight up ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So as they start moving up this, it's basically like it's still the same. Now it's a old dirt path. They called it a wagon path. And they're starting to ascend and walk up towards the back, and they noticed this smell, and it was like a sulfur smell, and it was coming from in front of them, and it started permeating coming down the path at a low level. At this point, Mrs. May was at a fence, and basically what it was, Tim, it was a fence that was between 3 and 4 foot high, and there were posts to the left and right, and Mrs. May told me that back then, there was just big posts with the slats that were nailed from left to right. So they had to climb over this.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have the second one. This is another obstacle. They start climbing over this fence, the first people. and the rest of them are strewn out behind like a wagon train.
Right, right.
So at this point, you had Mrs. May, Gene Lemon, Neil Nunley, Eddie May, and Ronald Shaver.
Plus the three dogs.
And there's one dog.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay?
The other one's bailed.
The other two dogs neglected to go any further. They wouldn't go past that fence.
Right.
The collie went ahead. So we have all the adults up front leading the path, and you have this sickening sulfur smell permeating down the path. Now, it's what Mrs. May told me. It's a slang word. She said there's a swag in the path. And I was never up there with Kathleen because she was physically incapable of going up there.
Right.
But I was up there several times with Freddie May.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened is as the collie went ahead, it started barking and it disappeared and it went into this. It was like a misty smoke.
Oh,
it was tearing ass up around the swag, and it went straight up and it basically disappeared because of this swag. It swings to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole time you're walking uphill. Freddie May, Teddy Neal, and little Tommy Heyer had reached that wooden fence. And they were just starting to climb over it. They never passed it. And the rest of the group is moving up ahead. All of a sudden, the dog starts barking its ass off. It takes off and lets out a yelp, and it runs back. And it runs past Mrs. May Lemon and all the boys, runs, and it jumps through the fence because the dog could get through
right,
it.
Right, right, yeah.
And it ran past Freddie, Teddy, and Tommy Heyer, and it went back to the house. So, and,
oh, my God.
And, you know, I'll kind of jump ahead a little bit.
Okay.
Ivan Sanderson reported that dog was found dead the next day on the veranda of somebody's porch.
Oh, God.
So, anyways, Mrs. May and Lemon, they're leading the pack. And the rest of the boys are strewn out in this wagon train. And Mrs. May and Gene Lemon each had flashlights. Lemon had a flashlight because he lived in the neighborhood, and he would walk back and forth and visit Mrs. May and the kids. And you always had a flashlight in West Virginia walking through the woods up there.
Yeah.
Mrs. May had a flashlight. Her and Lemon are walking side by side. Mrs. May is to the left-hand side of the path closer to the woods. Lemon's towards the outside, and the other boys are behind him. Mrs. May told me she heard this noise that sounded like a thumping noise. And it was basically, as she described it, it was like a stretched canvas, kind of like a drum.
Okay.
Like a tom-tom drum. And she heard this thumping, repetitive thumping. And she heard this noise that was like a hiss noise that sounded like air escaping from something. And as she started moving a little bit closer, to the left of her, there was this gigantic white oak tree. And it was set about 4 feet off to the left. And there's a little incline. There's a little roll there. It's not all level. And as Mrs. May started nearing this area, this is where it became a little bit thicker, where this was the point where this sulfur mist, it was like a gas, was emanating from. And it's coming from behind this tree area. Well, as Mrs. May started walking a little closer towards this tree, it set about 4 feet back. Lemon was behind her. They looked up, and about 12 feet up in the air, they noticed these two glowing eyes. They thought it was actually, because it was up that high, they thought it was some type of an animal perched up on a branch.
Yeah.
12 feet up in the air. It's like, what the hell else is going to be 12 foot high way up there? Plus, you have about a 3 or 4 foot incline. So these eyes are up pretty high up in the air. So as they neared this, they clicked on their flashlights, and they pointed their flashlights up into the woods. And it's about dusk now, and it was a little darker in the wooded area off to their left. And as they flashed the beams hit up into that area, Tim, this thing lit up. And Mrs. May told me it lit up like a Christmas tree. It illuminated from the inside. And this is what your Flatwoods Monster was. It was a 12-foot-tall metallic-like structure.
Hmm.
The thing actually had lifted off the ground. It was a hovercraft. And this hovercraft was actually, the propulsion system was the gas and the air and the hissing noise that was escaping from this craft lifted off the ground about a foot and a half, and it came down the four-foot incline and crossed over the path in front of them. Gene Lemon freaked out. He, Mrs. May's exact words, she said, his legs got rubbery. And he passed out momentarily, and he hit the ground.
Oh, God.
To Mrs. May's right. It just freaked the hell out of him. Mrs. May is standing there, and this thing hovered. She froze for a second, paralyzed in fear. The other kids kind of froze for a second. This thing scared the hell out of them. And it moved across in front of Mrs. May. It moved in front of Lemon, and it kept going off to the right, and it passed in front of Neil Nunley. And this thing actually moved across the path, and it went down into the gully, the valley to the right, where the craft was sitting off in the distance.
Right. Now, this thing you're describing, this is the infamous picture, right, that looks like some kind of entity of sorts?
That is the incorrect picture.
Okay.
Okay, that was kind of like the fable picture.
Okay.
That was drawn incorrectly. That's the ridiculous picture that's been shown for years.
Okay.
Being an illustrator, I was able to sit down with the witnesses,
mm-hmm.
and get the stories from them. And I worked with them. We'll get to that in a minute. So what happened is this thing is passing by in front of Mrs. May. It's actually splattering out this, like, blackish-gray oil.
Oh, God.
This thing was a machine. And it was splattering this stuff out, and it hit the front of her, and it hit some of the boys up that were up close to it, the ones that were right almost on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to get an idea of how close Kathleen was to this and Lemon. And Mrs. May said she was close to it as a car. And then she paused and she said, a small car. So this thing was approximately 15 feet away from her. And when I was playing the devil's advocate with her at first, during the first interview I did with her, and I wanted to know how long she saw this thing and if she got a good look at it. And she says, I got a good enough a look at it where I could sit down and we could start drawing pictures, and I started drawing pictures with her. She saw this thing basically up close and personal. This thing was almost on top of her. And I remember her saying it was close enough to me that it splattered oil all over the front of my uniform.
Yeah.
She was in a close proximity to it. What was cool about working with Kathleen and her son, Freddie had reached the gate. Remember I just mentioned that?
Mm-hmm.
He never crossed over it. He saw the whole thing fold out in front of him.
Right, from a distance, yeah.
From a distance, which was just, we measured it, it was just over about 30 feet. And so when I was working with Kathleen and working with Freddie, she was giving me the up close and personal descriptions of what this thing looked like. And she said she can actually feel heat from it.
Oh, boy.
And when I was doing my illustrations, which you could see online, and it's the cover of the book, Freddie was in the back. And
okay.
He was there with Tommy and Teddy Neal, so he saw everything unfold. So he gave me descriptions from his point of view.
Now, did she, A, save the uniform, or B, was there any sort of indication from, you know, from what got on her uniform as to, you know, what that stuff was at all?
She got back to the house, and she had taken the uniform off, and it was splattered. The kids had this crap all over their faces, and it had hit on parts of their clothing, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what happened is when they all turned and ran,
yeah,
Mrs. May, and this is a key point of how scared she was, she said she passed several of the boys on the way down. She said when she reached that gate, the wooden fence,
mm-hmm. yeah,
the second one, just before they got up there, she said she hurdled it in one bound.
Wow.
And that was between 3 and 4 feet high. And today they actually left that the posts up there. And I've been taking video footage for years up there. And it is about 3.5 to 4 foot high. I can actually see where the old nails were in there. And then, you know, I videotaped and took pictures of all of this.
Yeah.
So she did scale that. She hurdled it in one shot. And she told me I passed several of the boys on the way down. That's how scared she was back to the house. And the dogs and Freddie and the other kids had taken off. So they kind of had a head start. And they had to get back over the fence, the big metal fence, and none of them opened it up. They just kind of like the little kids crawled through it. The adults climbed over it.
Yeah.
They were so scared out of their wits when they saw this thing. They didn't have time. They just climbed over it, through it. They ran through it. The dogs jumped through it. They were climbing. And when they hit that open pasture, they were gone.
Yeah.
And they just tore ass back to the house. And when they got in there, some of the kids had fallen down, and they were cut up, and they were bruised because, you know, they fell going down the path. And
oh, yeah,
they were
sure.
Just
they're all
frantic,
backed up, yeah.
Frantic. So Mrs. May's mom was tending to the boys. Her dad was there, and he was helping out. And Gene Lemon, he got a real hell of a good whiff of this sulfur smell. And Kathleen May said he was just throwing his guts up.
Oh, God.
For a long time, and it affected him pretty well. And the kids were all coughing and gagging and wheezing. So that thing screwed him up pretty bad, Tim.
Yeah.
And they were trying to make sense of this thing. And, you know, you could just imagine the pandemonium that was going on in that house. And in the meantime, there was a posse that was getting together, and the word started traveling around throughout the area. And Mrs. May called the local sheriff's department, and Sheriff Carr wasn't in. He was around chasing objects that were repeatedly crashing through Flatwoods area and going into an area of Sugar Creek and Frametown down the Elk River, approximately 15 to 20 miles away. And what that was actually another damaged UFO. And we could get back into that a little bit later because all of this is, there's so much that happened that night. But basically, there was supposed to be a rendezvous in Flatwoods between two damaged craft.
Ah.
And what happened is the rendezvous was missed. This is all calculated and figured out, Tim, over years.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Of
yeah.
all my documentation.
Yeah.
And I was able to speak to some of the locals who were alive back then in the early 90s. I got local newspapers. And when I really got rocking and rolling into this thing, the people were supporting me like crazy, and they were giving me articles. They still give me articles and mail me stuff, but the locals were, like, giving me stuff and check this out. And so this whole community that was had me at bay for a while has opened up to me all of a sudden. So now I have this gigantic puzzle with all of these pieces, and I'm trying to sort it together. I reviewed some of Gray Barker's notes and Ivan Sanderson, and I'm taking all of this information, just throwing it into one pot and trying to make sense out of it. And it did drive Sanderson and especially Gray Barker crazy trying to figure out what had happened, because there were so many UFOs that were seen over Flatwoods.
Mm-hmm.
And that Braxton County region, they couldn't figure out why so many people were describing different crafts. And these crafts were seen up close and at low levels, Tim.
Yeah.
And some of them were like 60-foot long cigar-shaped objects that looked like jets with no wings. There were oval-shaped objects. There were round-shaped objects. There was another round-shaped object that had a flat side to it. So you have a variety of different crafts there. And when Barker started looking into this more in depth, he just couldn't figure it out. Why are these people all describing these different crafts when there was only thought to be one that had crashed, that had the Flatwoods Monster, the
right.
occupant of the damaged craft? And it turned out it was a search and rescue mission. And I actually tracked these UFOs coming in to that area. And there were some that came up from the southern part of the United States, and the other ones actually flew over Washington, D.C. and Virginia and flew in west. And every time I would do a book signing, I would go up there, and Stanton told me this was going to happen over the years. People would stand in the corner, and they would wait till the crowd leaves and the autograph people, and they would walk up to me, and these old-timers would walk up to me, and they would start telling me these stories.
Yeah.
And it's embedded in my head because I've been doing it for so many years. And these people lived in Braxton County and other counties, and they were talking about seeing these different crafts flying at low level. And I would just pull my map out, and it's connecting the dots. It was seen here, 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 and here.
Yeah. Well,
and I traced them back to Washington, D.C. So these craft actually had come in over Washington, D.C. and headed west and went in looking for it.
That's just crazy. Now, I'm looking at your website here, flatwoodsmonster.com, and I see the cover of the book. And so that's what we're seeing, what I'm seeing, what folks can see at flatwoodsmonster.com on the cover of the book. That's more of an accurate depiction of what these kids and Kathleen saw that night, as opposed to the black and white drawing that's so infamous.
Right, right. And the reason for the nickname of the Green Monster, mm-hmm, is it was actually, Tim, it was like an aluminum gray color. It, mm-hmm, wasn't super shiny, according to the witnesses, but what had happened is this thing, according to the witnesses, says it had some type of an interior lighting system, and it lit up from the inside, and when the flashlights from Lemon and May's flashlights, when the beams hit this thing, the thing lit up, and it reflected the green from around it.
Okay, yeah.
It was an Indian summer, and the leaves hadn't changed yet. So you have all the green around from the shrubbery, from the trees, the foliage, the grass, and everything. And it actually reflected the green, plus this thing lit up from the inside. So you have two different light sources.
Right, right.
Reflecting, that's why they called it the Green Monster. It wasn't really green. It was an aluminum color.
Right, and it wasn't even really a monster. It sounds like this was more, as you said earlier, sort of a hovercraft. This is more,
yeah,
maybe
it was actually,
like a skate pod or some kind, or something like,
exactly,
that.
Exactly. No. It was a craft, and there's a million and one different write-ups of what was found, the trace evidence in the field. There were two paths. The locals up there from the get-go called them skid marks. What they actually were, there were two paths, and these paths were parallel, and they ran over to the area where it was pressed down, where the craft had sat down, after relocated into the gully. And when Stanton Friedman was there from the first time, the 50th anniversary, went up there, he just stood there, and he was totally amazed, because when you stand there on a property and you look, this thing had landed on the high point in the pasture, and then it relocated, and it was, you know, tucked away in the corner so it wouldn't be seen, because this thing was glowing and flashing. Mm. You don't want to be sitting on a mountaintop.
Right, it was kind of high.
Glowing. Though. Yeah, so it's tucked away there. Well, what happened is there was one set of tracks coming out from the craft area across this gully. It went up the incline. It went across the path up to the tree. And when this thing departed, it followed like snow print, footprints in the, mm-hmm, snow. It followed a parallel path back to the craft. And the path, each one was approximately 4 foot wide. What this monster was, for lack of better words, was actually a hovercraft. Remember Mrs. May said it hovered a foot to a foot and a half?
Right.
There were actually rocks that were blown over inside the path. And the grass was pushed over, and it was likened to like having a gigantic leaf blower and,
right,
walking through this high grass that was like knee to waist high, mm-hmm, just walking one direction and then moving back away from the tree again. And that was a parallel path that went. The locals called them skid marks. They were actually, it was actually grass, and this was like a hovercraft vehicle that blew this grass to pieces and shook everything inside of it.
Well, looking at this new drawing of the craft, it's remarkable the arrogance of the skeptics who say these people just saw an owl. It's like there's no way you could confuse what's drawn here with an owl. That's just not even possible. It's amazing.
Well, what happened, the whole myth of the monster came about with the drawing is Mrs. May was contacted by NBC Studios in New York, and there was a show back then called We the People, and Daniel Seymour was the host of the show. It started out as a radio show, then it became a radio and TV show, and they would have different guests on there. Well, this story hit so fast and furious around the United States, Mrs. May was contacted and invited to go to New York, and it was kind of like a talk show.
Yeah.
And Mrs. May, Ailey Stewart Jr., who was the co-owner of the Braxton Democrat with his dad, and he was in the Air Force. He was a vet in Korea. He got invited, and Gene Lemon. They all went to New York on September 19th. They flew out of Charleston. They went into the city, and they were to be interviewed for that. It was exactly 1 week later on September 19th. Well, they all go into the studios, and I work with Ailey Stewart very close to. He was kind of the backbone of the story because he broke the story mm-hmm. to the press through the Charleston Gazette. I actually went up to his home when he was alive, and I stayed there for a whole weekend, about 3 days, and I just hung out with him, and we went over the story, and I interviewed and I taped them. So he kind of set the backbone of the story because his newspaper was the hub.
Right.
And they had received telephone calls, and there was correspondence from countries from all over the world. It was amazing. I have newspaper articles in different languages. I have a collection of Flatwoods Monster articles from around the world, and people still send me stuff too, Tim. It's amazing.
Amazing, yeah. That's
how far this story had reached. It was even in military paper, Stars and Stripes, in the Pacific. Somebody sent me an article a couple years ago from that. So this story basically had hit into Japan and Asia and was in Europe just in a few days.
It was
unbelievable how far-reaching this was. Mrs. May even got a call from a guy who was stationed in Japan. He actually called their house.
Jeez.
Because when this story hit on the news wires and it was read in the Stars and Stripes, it was a guy who actually lived in Braxton County, and he read this in the paper, and he heard about it in the media, and he called back there.
Oh, my God.
So it was really far-reaching. So Ailey Stewart was a key part of this whole thing, and he was actually the first one there on site. After going to the May's house, he got the call to go up there from the state police because the sheriff's running around looking for crashed things, you know, going through the mountains.
Hmm.
He's driving around like a nut. And what had happened is it was actually the same object was puddle jumping and crashing throughout Braxton County. So he would get a call, the report. He would go to point A. Nothing.
He was already off to point C or something, yeah.
Right, and he kept going back to the police department and like, oh, guess what, we got another call. So then he's going out to point B and back, and he's driving back and forth going nuts, going, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah.
And I actually retraced the sheriff's path. I went up with a friend of mine years ago, and we timed how far it was because this is all documented from point A to B to mm-hmm. here, back and forth and back and forth. And we clocked our mileage, how long it took. So that's when I wrote the book. I figured out the timeline of everything around there, of what was going on. Then I interviewed another fellow, Jack Davis, who saw the craft coming in from a different part, and he was an adult. So I have all these different people coming forward and telling me stuff. So I'm plotting all these points all over, driving all over, putting my story and timeline together. And Stewart had actually received a call from the West Virginia State Police to go up there because the local sheriff wasn't there. The word spread around pretty quick. Now, Stewart was a photojournalist, and he was contacted by the state police because they couldn't get there either. We don't know why they couldn't get there. You know, that's one thing that Stewart told me when I interviewed him. He says, I don't know why they couldn't get there. All I was told is get your rafts up to the May house because something happened up there. The lady called, Mrs. May, and there's her and a bunch of kids are hysterical. Go check it out.
Right.
So he was friends with the police department because he would go to the different scenes with the police. Being a photojournalist, he had a killer camera, so he would take pictures of the crime scenes, accidents. So he was pretty tight with the police. So he actually represented the police department. So he went up there, and he walked into the house. He was like the first person of authority in the house, and he described to me the pandemonium of what was going on in that house. He said it was hysterical.
I can imagine. Not in a funny way, right?
You know, he said the kids were freaking out and crying. He said Mrs. May, her eyes were all red, and they were tearing and weepy. Some of the kids were bleeding because they had fallen down. They're freaked out. Now, in the meantime, you have all the locals getting together because the crap hit the fan, small little community. They want to know what's going on. So they form a posse. Now you have a whole bunch of armed men, including Stewart, and he told me he always carried a handgun and one or two shotguns and a rifle with him because, you know, when you're covering stories up there,
yeah,
you go
to
so many collars, you don't know what you're going to run into. And Stewart and Mrs. May's dad and a bunch of the local guys, we're going to go up and check out and see what happened. Here's all of their kids are all messed up, and they want to know what the hell's going on back there. And in the meantime, the kids are starting to tell Stewart what they had seen. So, you know, that was kind of disturbing. So Stewart gets together with his posse, and they all go up to the farm. Now they have to get somebody to show them where it happened, because now it's pitch dark.
Right.
And you're walking up into those mountains there, and they had a lot of nerve to do that. And they had what Stewart called electric lanterns. And they were like big, giant flashlights, like lanterns, kind of like what they would use in mines. And he told me they got the oldest boys together. And he said, he didn't tell me in too much detail, but he said one of the boys, he grabbed them by the back of the collar. And he said he was crying like a whipped pup.
Yeah.
He was like a little squirrel girl. This kid was shit in his pants. He did not want to go up there. He was shaking.
Yeah.
You can't blame the kid. I wouldn't want to go back up there.
Believe
either.
Me, I'm 34 years old. If it happened to me, I'd be shitting my pants too. So
yeah,
no harm on that guy.
And he said he was crying like a whipped pup. And he basically dragged him up the hill by the scruff of the neck. And, you know, they're trying to comfort this guy. You know, here's like half of the town is going up there with shotguns and, you know, rifles, handguns. So they all work their way up. They go up into the area. And as they got closer up and just past the area where the wooden fence was, they got across there and they started noticing the smell.
Okay, yeah.
And Stewart knew about how gas settled from being in the war, that chemical warfare and whatnot, that the gas settles. So he told me he got down on his hands and knees, and he was smelling this sulfur crap that was across the whole area. And he said, this is the smell that they were describing. He said he looked down, and he scanned his electric lantern to the right, and he saw the big, gigantic marks, the two paths I mentioned
earlier.
Going out into that area. And he said as he was walking through the area, they just stayed for a little while because, and this is what he says, we were not inclined to hunt for something in the dark that we didn't know what it was.
Yeah, especially if it came from space. You don't know what you're
going to
do.
Yeah, so, you know, at this point, they don't know. The kids didn't want to stay up there, the older boys, so they kind of hightailed it out of there, and they went back to the house. So all these different points of the story, Tim, is what I'm getting at, is I worked with all these individuals.
Right. I mean, this is
exclusive interviews from Stewart, from Mrs. May, from Freddie, I had talked to Mr. Shaver. I met Freddie's brother, Eddie. His name is Edison.
Mm-hmm.
I met all these key players. I worked with Jack Davis. He saw the craft coming in. And then I have all the past investigations from the early 50s. And most of those people are dead, so I had to go on a lot of their data, and it just was like one gigantic jigsaw puzzle trying to put everything together. But eventually I did it, and I tightened it up. And since the book was released last year, I found out more information. And I'm just piecing it together and piecing it together over the past year, and that's why I have this expanded version that's out. It's probably the most definitive investigation into not only Flatwoods, but probably just about any case.
It's
because it was so well documented back then, and it got forgotten about. Everybody made fun of it. And as I'm going along, and I found more information out since this book came out.
Oh, sure.
I got more stuff, you know, and it's doing shows like this and being in the media, you know, doing book signings and travel and doing radio shows and this and that. People contact me and they're sending me stuff. Give me your address. I got stuff. You wouldn't believe this stuff people send.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's like, oh, my God, here we go. Here's more stuff. Here's going to be another revised edition.
Right,
you know?
Right.
OG ready. He turns on the rubber, the 2-2 home. Swing and a miss. He struck him out. The 2013 Red Sox are the world champions and Boston strong.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Bedlam at Fenway Park as the Red Sox clinch the World Series at Fenway for the first time in 95 years. From last to best, the Red Sox have won their third world championship in 10 years.